very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Everyone knows about famous or perhaps notorious U.S. Marshals. Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson come to mind. But what about Heck Thomas? Heck was one of the so-called three guardsmen who were tasked with bringing law to the Indian territories. Though he often worked alone, Heck would bring more outlaws to justice than any other marshal working the Indian territories. Or how about Ada Carnot, one of the first women to ever wear a deputy marshal's badge? In 1893, she single-handedly arrested two forgers and personally escorted them to jail. Ada was as tough as they come. But that was the Old West. How many of you know there are still manhunters out there quietly doing their duty and fulfilling a rather unique role in our justice system? Now, here on American Warrior Radio, we've talked with many of our federal-level sheepdogs, FBI, Secret Service, CIA, DEA, ATF. But I realize there is one we overlooked until today, the United States Marshals. Joining us today on American Warrior Radio to help fix that oversight on my part is David Gonzalez, 18 years as the U.S. Marshal for Arizona, appointed by the U.S. President, actually three U.S. Presidents. David, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you, Ben. How could you forget the U.S. Marshals are the oldest federal law enforcement agency in the country?
Well, I'm kicking myself, David. That's why, you know. Now, let me just say, point of personal privilege here, David. A, thrilled to have you on the show finally. My apologies for not doing it sooner.
No problem.
B, I tell you, one of the nice things about doing a radio show is on occasion you're out in the public and you get feedback. So Laura and I are having breakfast at a local diner, I don't know, a couple weeks, about a month ago, and there was about eight to ten fellows all sitting around a table. They all had military hats on. So being shameless, I went up and introduced myself with, you know, a bunch of business cards in my hand, and about six of them said, "Oh no, we listen to your show. We listen to it every week." I'm like, "Great." So then I say, "Well, yeah, we got some great guests coming up," and I mentioned your name, and one salty old dog, David, said, "Oh, if you're going to have Gonzo on, you might as well kiss your show goodbye." So, greetings from Ed Schlechta.
Oh yes, he was a sergeant of mine when I was with the Arizona Department of Public Safety before I was appointed U.S. Marshal. Great guy and a legend in DPS.
Well, it's a small world. Now, first things first, David, you are the U.S. Marshal for Arizona, appointed and reappointed, I think, by so far three presidents.
Yes, I was initially appointed. Let me just back up a little bit. The U.S. Marshal Service, there are 94 federal districts in the country, and the president appoints a U.S. attorney and a U.S. marshal for every district. In Arizona, is one district. A lot of other states have two or three. But I was initially appointed by George W. Bush in 2002, reappointed by President Obama, and then reappointed by President Trump.
So here's what I'm getting at. Can you deputize me for the next hour?
For 1 hour, but you can't arrest anybody. You got to let me know first, okay?
I'm pointing at my producer right now. Sweet, you just fulfilled a lifelong dream of mine.
Okay.
Deputy U.S. Marshal BBG. Thank you for that, David.
And your IQ probably doubled, right?
Well,
I don't know about, or you're cut in half, one of the two.
Well, I'm certainly taller and more handsome. Let's leave it at that.
But, there you go.
So, David, a little bit about you. You know, so often you watch these cop movies, and a phrase you hear is, you're no altar boy. Well, in your case, you literally are an altar boy.
I was an altar boy. I was born and raised in Flagstaff and went to Catholic school, a Nativity Blessed Virgin Mary school in Flagstaff, and was an altar boy. And I was raised by my grandparents. My mother died when I was very young. And when I graduated from Flagstaff High School, I had a half a scholarship to go to NAU, and I was on my own at this time. And I needed a job desperately just to make ends meet. I was initially hired as a sheriff's deputy in Coconino County in Flagstaff at 19 years old as a patrol deputy. They don't do that anymore. You know, they changed the law. You have to be 21 to be a certified police officer.
Let me interrupt you right there. So you're 19, you're carrying a gun, but you still can't buy ammunition.
I can't buy ammunition. I couldn't buy a gun. So I would have to go to my sergeant, you know, or a family member, or uncle or something, and say, hey, can you buy me some bullets for my service revolver, you know?
I tell you, David, when we have folks on the show, we always ask, well, why did you choose the Marines, or why did you choose the Secret Service? And sometimes you have some pretty unique stories. I got to tell you, your route to a career as a U.S. Marshal is somewhat odd, because you started off by sneaking into a cemetery.
Oh, I did. The
common...
first time I was ever arrested was, you know, when we were growing up, we loved to watch the NAU Lumberjacks play, and we couldn't afford to get into the game, so the old stadium was adjacent to a cemetery, and we would sneak into the cemetery, crawl underneath the fence, and watch a game. And one night, myself and three of my buddies were picked up by a Flagstaff police officer, and you know, he grabbed us by the collar, and we thought we were going to jail forever. And he escorted us into the stadium went to the middle of the stadium, first row, and sat us down, and he said, stay there till the game's over, and disappeared. So I thought, well, after the game, we thought, well, are we free to go? And then we realized that this cop was doing us a big favor and was helping us out, and I never forgot that.
Is that a lesson you carried through your career? Now, maybe not so much as a U.S. Marshal, because most of the folks you're going after are truly, truly bad guys. But when you were a deputy, is that something you kind of kept in the back of your mind? The whole, you know, would you get more bees or more flies with sugar than whatever goes? I don't know.
Yeah, it did stick with me. And, you know, when I was a deputy sheriff in Flagstaff, and, you know, after 2 years, I transferred or was hired by DPS as a trooper and sent to Tucson. And even as a U.S. Marshal here, I think police officers should use a lot of discretion. And when you make an arrest, you know, it's for the right reasons and for, you know, what good are you doing here? You know, and that always stuck with me. And some people need a break, others don't. But that time that policeman put the collar on me and took me to watch the game at the best seats in the house has always stuck with me.
David, for the next hour, you and I are going to have a couple things in common. We're both U of A public administration graduates. For the next 50 minutes, a U.S. Marshal. One thing, though, that I wanted to be a cop, studied criminal justice, did a lot of ride-alongs, volunteered out at the county jail. And what that taught me, David, was I should not be a police officer, a good learning experience. But one comment, I saw an interview where you talked about one of the things that kind of spurred you along this path, as well as some very exciting ride-alongs that you had done. I tell you, when I go out, it's almost like crime ceases.
Yes.
Very boring.
Yeah, you know, when I was attending NAU, I was going to be a teacher. I was a big history buff, and thought, well, I'll be a history teacher. And I took a police science class, and got to know a Flagstaff police officer who was finishing his degree, and we hit it off. And he says, "Hey, what are you doing Friday night? Why don't you come out and ride with me?" And I said, "Well, not doing anything." And so I went out with him, and you know. We went to, you know, several calls, a burglary call, you know, different things, and I was hooked. You know, it's like, oh, this would be a great career, and that's when I was hired by the sheriff's department. There's a sheriff there named Joe Richards. He was a sheriff there for 30 years, and you know, he saw something in me, and I don't know if I would have hired me at 19 years old, but he saw something in me. And, you know, there's always somebody in your career that gave you a boost, that helped you up, that led you on your life. And Joe Richards was that man for me, because, you know, hiring me at 19 years old, I went to a regional police academy there, and then was patrolling, you know, within, you know, 3 or 4 months. And that man set me off. He really did.
David, you had several stops on your way to becoming the U.S.
Yes.
Marshal for Arizona. The next stop was at the Department of Public Safety for the state of Arizona.
Yeah.
Tell us, and I tell you, there's a great story you tell about when you went undercover. I want to hold that till after the break, because that's a very interesting story. But how did you get from the sheriff department to DPS? Did they recruit you? Did someone, again, one of those mentors, see something in you and make a suggestion, or was something else that caused you to take that next step?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in Flagstaff. I knew everybody and hadn't really gone anywhere in my life. I have no trips, you know, never had a, never been out of state. And I would see these DPS guys when I was a sheriff's deputy, and they had big white fancy cars and that Smokey the Bear hat, which I really liked. And I thought, man, that sounds really interesting, and maybe it's an opportunity to move out of Flagstaff. I love Flagstaff. I'm related to half the town and know everybody, but I just wanted something different. So I applied for DPS, and I was hired right after I turned 21. And when I graduated from the academy, they sent me to Tucson. And I hadn't finished school yet, so it was an ideal situation. I wanted to go to Phoenix or Tucson, and went to Tucson. I'd never been there before, and it was a great opportunity. To work in Tucson in southern Arizona, which I love. Ended up spending 10 years there. Finished up at U of A, met my wife there, so it was a blessing. It really was.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, temporary deputy U.S. Marshal Ben Buehler Garcia.
There you go.
you're gonna catch some flack for this, David. I'm joined by U.S. Marshal for Arizona, David Gonzalez. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler Garcia. We're very pleased to be joined by the U.S. Marshal for Arizona, David Gonzalez, not Deputy U.S. Marshal, the U.S. Marshal, one of, I think you said, 94 in the country, correct, David?
94 federal districts, and there's a presidentially appointed U.S. Marshal for every one of those districts, yes.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, we were teasing before we took the break about your transition to the Department of Public Safety. It wasn't very long before you were assigned to go undercover, and
yes.
I've seen a photo of that, David. I hope you don't share that with the world.
Oh, geez. Yeah. I know which one you're talking about. And yeah, you know, I worked patrol for 2 years on graveyard shift because I was going to school, and this was in the late 70s now, and there was a big push for narcotics agents within DPS. They were really beefing up. Drugs were really pouring, were starting to pour, had been pouring over the border. And I was 23. I looked like I was 16. I could speak some Spanish. It was Flagstaff Spanish. But I could get by. I was approached and said, hey, would you like to work narcotics? And I thought, well, yeah, sounds great. So transferred to narcotics after 2 years as a trooper. You did all the things you did there. My job was to infiltrate these dealers and cartel members and start buying drugs, running informants, in the underbelly of the drug world, and primarily there in Tucson, but we would work everywhere. But most of my narcotics work was obviously in the Tucson, Pima County area.
David, I heard an interview you did with one of my favorite ATF agents, Jay Dobbins, another U of A product.
I love that man.
Good dude. You're talking about one particular undercover operation. I think it was someone by the name of Valenzuela.
Yes.
Here in southern Arizona, and that pretty dicey situation for you.
Oh yeah, you know, this is a case where we did a lot of those, but this is a perfect example where everything could go wrong in a case. Turned out okay at the end, but there was a lot of pucker factor involved in this one. And I was buying several. I was introduced to this Valenzuela guy, and he was a big weed dealer in Tucson at the time. And I was buying several hundred pounds of marijuana from him. I think back then a pound of marijuana cost around $450 a pound. So you know, it was a sizable amount of money involved. My partner and I met him at a shopping center at Oracle and. I think it was McGee, right in there, and we agreed that, you know, we'd exchange money once I picked up the dope, and we'd bring the back, and then everybody would go their happy ways. And so we made arrangements for me to go with Renee in his car to pick up the dope. My partner would stay with his partner at the shopping center, and when we got back the dope, we'd make the exchange. And so I get in his car with him. It was a big SUV, and as soon as I get in, he pulls out a .45, he puts it to my head, and says, "Get on the floorboard." And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, this isn't supposed to go this way." And I had a bug on, an airplane was doing surveillance. I learned later that the bug was not working, and the surveillance airplane lost me immediately. And I was on my own, and I didn't know it. And good thing I didn't know it. And it was really interesting. At that time, the bugs that we wore were real cumbersome. They were about the size of a cigarette pack with two wires that came up, and you'd stick the device itself down in your groin area. It had like three or four large batteries, and it'd get real hot, if you know what I mean.
Boy, yeah.
Yeah, so it was no fun. And then they would tape the two antennas. One was an antenna and one was a mic on your chest with like masking tape. And it was interesting times, and I thought everything that everyone was listening, and the airplane was telling where I was. And so anyways, we traveled for about 15 minutes, and I'm laying down on the floorboard, and Valenzuela tells me, he says, "Hey, I'm not going to shoot you unless something goes wrong, but I just don't want you to know where I live." I thought, well, okay. So we finally slow down. I hear a garage door opening. We pull into the garage door, his garage, and he says, "Okay, you can get out." As I'm getting out of the car, I realize I'm about three blocks from my house. So made it more, even more interesting. And then as we're getting out of the car and going into his house, he grabs all his children. He had two or three kids. And in Spanish, he tells them, "Hey, grab the mota," which was street term for marijuana. And all the kids started bringing packages of marijuana away. And we weighed him there in the garage at a large scale. And after we weighed him, weighed the dope, we say, "You want a beer before we go back?" And we said, so I'm walking down his hallway. I see these things on his wall, and it said Valenzuela, Rene Valenzuela, first degree black belt. You know, the next one said Rene Valenzuela, second degree black belt. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is going to be really interesting on the takedown if we ever get there, you know. So anyways, we leave his house, makes me lay down again on the floorboard, we go back to the shopping center, and as soon as we get out of the area, he lets me get up, and I knew I needed to do some kind of diversion so I could alert everybody that this guy, you know, he didn't have a gun, but he's a third degree black belt and very dangerous. And I said, "Renee, you know, that weed you're selling me is not the quality you told me it was. There's a lot of stem and seeds in it. I need to talk to Steve, who's my partner, who's an undercover officer." And I said, "This is half his money." And it was several hundred thousand dollars. And if he sees this weed, he's going to back out. And we can't do that. We're this close to making a lot of money. And he goes, "Yeah, please go talk to him and settle him down." So when we get to the shopping center, I told Steve, my partner, I said, "Hey, this guy has a weed. You pick all this up." And he goes, "Hey, I don't know. I've been with this guy here, but the surveillance teams, I couldn't see the surveillance teams in the parking lot, so I started to get really nervous. So I gave a move-in, a verbal move-in signal that we would do in this case, and nobody was coming in. So then I did a visual move-in signal, and about that time I heard the car starting up and coming in. And they surrounded Renee and arrested him. Everything went fine, but he went to jail, gets out about a week later on bond, and I was out jogging one day down Ina Road around La Cholla to Oracle, and I see this car coming the other way, and I said, "Man, that car looks familiar," and then got closer. I said, "Yeah, that guy looks familiar, that's Renee, you know?" And he sees me, and he slams on the brakes and comes after me, starts chasing me. And I run into the neighborhood there off Ina Road, and I'm jumping over fences and the yards, and, you know, dogs are barking, and I jump over a bunch of other fences, and I hit in someone's behind a tool shed, and I could hear him driving around in the neighborhood, and he finally disappears. And I was after about a half hour of sitting there waiting until he was gone, I ran back home, called my sergeant, and explained to him what happened, and he called the team together, and they went and visited Renee, and I can only imagine the conversation they had with him, but never had a problem with him again, and I know he went to prison for a few years, and then a couple years, I don't know, 3-4 years later, I'm at a movie theater. There's Campbell and Speedway. I can't remember the name of it right now.
Campbell Plaza, yeah.
Yeah, and he's ended coming out, and I see Renee and his wife, and he just looked at me, turned around, kept walking. So I thought, well, he got the message. You know, I was doing my job. He was doing his job, whatever that was. And, you know, I won that day, so I think he just, we just went our separate ways. But that was another one of those interesting cases where, you know, you learn from things that things would go bad and expect them to go bad, especially on undercover drug deals where there's so many things that can go wrong in those things and can be very, very dangerous.
David, I tell you what, most of us, myself included, after that experience would just go the other way and decide to maybe seek out another career. But you being a type A personality, you said,
yeah.
Hey, I think I'm going to go on to be a U.S. Marshal. When we come back from this break, I want to talk more about the Marshals, who they are, what they do, and hopefully you'll have some other great stories
to
share with us. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Arizona U.S. Marshal David Gonzalez. We'll be right back. Back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Apologies, we're having some telephone communications with our deputy, our U.S. Marshal, David Gonzalez. Hopefully he didn't get called out to chase some bad guys. I tell you what inspired me to do this show, and as we talked about at the outset of the show, I feel a little bit guilty because of all the federal agencies we've had on the show before, I'd neglected the U.S. Marshals. I mean, we talk about Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, and then, of course, Seth Bullock, who was the U.S. Marshal featured in the Deadwood series, also highly visible. But my wife and I love watching and binge-watching these cop cam shows, and so often you see the U.S. Marshals there, and it really struck me, hey, you need to get these guys on. So we're very, very pleased to have the U.S. Marshal for Arizona, David Gonzalez, joining us back again. Dave, do we got you?
Yeah, it'll happen. I lost you there for a minute.
Well, I think, you know, we were just talking about that big drug dealer you sent to jail, and next thing you know, your line goes dead.
That or the Russians. Who knows?
Russians or Chinese. We'll venture on. I tell you, if you are on a mobile device, please try not to wander around much. That gives us a bad signal. But, David, let's talk about the Marshals. 3,571 deputy U.S. Marshals and criminal investigators. That's a pretty small agency as far as federal law enforcement goes, isn't it?
Yeah, we're very small, probably one of the smallest in the Department of Justice. And, you know, we're in the Department of Justice with FBI, DEA, ATF, and I think Marshall's about the same size, but we are pretty small.
David, let's talk about, because it's interesting to me, as I sort of teased, Laura and I love watching these cop cam shows, and very often the Marshals are the one that are going in to serve the warrant or doing the takedown. But let's talk about some of the roles of people. I definitely want to get into that because I've got some specific questions, but let's talk about the roles that people may not understand. The first is judicial security. I love walking into a federal courthouse and seeing that deputy marshal badge on those men and women's chests.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. When you walk into a federal courthouse, you'll see these men and women in blue blazers. They are not deputy marshals. They're all retired cops. We oversee a contract that they work in, but a lot of people do think that they're deputy marshals, but they are They are they do work closely with us, and we work very closely. We have oversight over the building, obviously, and we coordinate their activities. But they're great men and women. We hire for usually retired police officers or people with some law enforcement background to work in those positions.
So now that I've made that mistake, are you going to pull my deputy badge?
Well, we'll give you a pass on this one because that's a pretty common thought about those men and women.
Speaking of little known roles, I went to your website and was pulling some data from 2019. In 2019, the U.S. Marshals helped to recover 275 missing children.
Yes. One of the we have some very unique duties. One of them is obviously arresting and hunting down fugitives worldwide. We manage the witness protection program, which is a fascinating, very secretive program. As part of our investigative assignments that we have is Adam Walsh Act. And, you know, prior to the passing of Adam Walsh Act, sex offenders could go from state to state to state and kind of hide out, and law enforcement communities really didn't know where these individuals were. So what the Adam Walsh Act did was it made it a federal crime to not check in the communities that you're moving to. And so we keep very active, very busy with those individuals, with those sex offenders, because they create a lot of problems, obviously, and more likely to reoffend again if you don't keep a close eye on them and arrest those individuals who do not comply with those requirements.
David, you mentioned witness security, or what most of us civilians know is witness protection. About
right.
19,000 people since 1971, and not a single witness who follows your guidelines and your rules has ever been harmed or killed.
Exactly. And we have very strict guidelines for individuals that go into the witness protection program. You know, obviously those individuals, you know, usually the vast majority of them have a criminal background, you know, like we had Sammy the Bull here for a while. But they do follow our guidelines, it's been 100% successful. But then there are individuals who will not follow our guidelines or for some reason decide to violate our policies and procedures, and we have to kick them out, or they voluntarily leave because they cannot handle, you know, abiding by our requirements. And then you can imagine what has happened to some of those individuals.
Yeah, I sure can. David, 18 years as a U.S. Marshal, you know, witness protection is the stuff of so many movie scripts, whether it be dramas or comedies. Any weird stories that you can remember for you in witness protection that you can share, or everybody just followed the rules and kept their head down and nothing exciting, nothing to see here?
Well, you know, I can't talk too much about the witness protection program because it's probably one of the most secretive programs in the federal government, but We do get a lot of situations where, especially with local police, where somebody commits a crime and is arrested by, say, DPS or Phoenix PD or Tucson PD, and the person might be in the program, and you know, and they're trying to get out of a charge, and they come to us, and we can't confirm or deny the person's in the program. But there are ways that we can work around that. And then there are also individuals who will get in trouble who claim they're in the program who aren't, to try to get away from charges.
Sure.
So it's a very unique program, and it's very, very interesting. And you know, our job is when somebody comes into the program, we change everything about them, their background, their, you know, birth certificates and all that stuff, as you can imagine, and then try to place them in a place where they can thrive.
Now, David, is this for the life of the witness, or just until somebody decides they're out of danger, or?
It's for life, but there are some individuals after a long period of time might say, you know, we check in with them and they're doing fine, and then they moved on in their life. I remember I was given a talk one time to a bunch of lawyers, and afterwards, a young lady attorney came up, and she said, "Hey, when I was a young girl, I was about 12 years old. Some U.S. Marshals came to my house in the middle of the night. They told my parents and me and my brother to pack one suitcase. We're going to leave in a half hour. And her father was being placed in the witness protection program. He was involved in some organized crime activity. And we changed her name. And she said, you know, the name I'm going by is the name the deputy marshal gave me. And they moved us to Phoenix. And the deputy marshal said, told her that she was a very bright gal. You know, she could be an attorney. And she went to law school based on that. And she was there were tears in her eyes on how the deputy marshal and the program, although it was very traumatic for her and her family, what a change it made in her life, and she was able to move on and be very successful.
Outstanding. David, I you said you couldn't share very much. Can you give us a guesstimate? What is the budget for that nationwide?
Oh, it's I can't give you the budget, but you can imagine, because when someone goes in the program, we have to, pay them monthly stipends. We have to rent their house, they need a car. Food, we work to get them jobs so they can live on their own. One of the problems is a lot of these individuals, especially if they're involved in organized crime, have never worked a day in their life and have no skills other than committing crime. So trying to get them into a regular, job can be very, very difficult for those individuals. Plus they can't make contact with, former friends and family members without our knowledge.
I mentioned the dollars, but let's talk a little bit about that. Asset forfeiture is something else the marshals are responsible for. You're the primary custodians for seized property, which includes vehicles, real estate, antiques. As of September 30th, 2019, the value of those forfeited assets, $2.86 billion with a B dollars.
Yes.
What happens to this stuff?
Well, that money goes to hire investigators, analysts for FBI, DEA, ATF, and the U.S. Marshal Service, so it doesn't come out of tax dollars. And they're also used to, and also attorneys with the Department of Justice, a lot of those. And it's also used to fund criminal investigations. You get involved in a criminal organized crime case could go on for years and years. They're very, very expensive. So instead of using taxpayers' dollars, we use money that have been taken from criminals from their ill-gotten gains, which I think is a good deal for taxpayers.
David, again, back to the 18 years experience question. What is the weirdest thing asset you've ever seen seized? A tiger, maybe?
Well, we try to stay away from anything that eats or what, because it just it can be very, very expensive. But from gold bullion, gold bars, antiques. And obviously, it's asset forfeiture can be very controversial, and they try to. There's been a lot of legislation to try to do away with it. Some people think it's not fair because you can seize items from people in some cases where they haven't been convicted yet, but we can prove that there were ill-gotten gains. For example, we'll arrest drug dealers who claim on their yearly income tax they made $30,000. Working at McDonald's, but they're living in $1 million house and they're driving Rolls Royces and all their things. So it's obvious, they're laundering money, and those are the kind of assets that we will seize. But there have been times where they've seen exotic animals and racehorses and things like that that we try to stay away from. But then it's our job to sell those types of assets back. And to get some of that funding and put it back into the investigative pot.
And practical question: are there's just auctions that people can attend, or do you give them to the local agencies that are doing auctions anyway? Or
no, we have our own auctions, and we'll have auctions for vehicles, even for gold coins, jewelry, houses. We do those all the time, and. If you check our websites, you'll see, and I've known people, we seize a lot of houses from people involved in organized crime and other crimes. And we'll show up at a house and and sell it to the highest bidder. So, yeah, we sell all those back to the public.
David, give us that website because I want my listeners to do some homework. When we come back, I want to talk about fugitive apprehension. I want them to take a peek at the top 15 most wanted. What is the website?
USMarshals.gov.
There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with U.S. Marshal for Arizona, David Gonzalez. When we come back, we'll talk about what they're doing with fugitives. It's going to be fascinating. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, recently deputized Marshal Ben Bueller Garcia. That's only going to last about 10 minutes, so don't worry about it. But we are joined with a real U.S. Marshal, David Gonzalez. 18 years is a U.S. Marshal, and he is the Marshal for Arizona. David, want to talk about the fugitive apprehension part of your job. I think that's the one thing most people are familiar if they don't.
Yes.
You know, if they're not those folks who assume that the Marshals went away after the Old West. Ben's going to get a lot of dumb questions in here, David, but what triggers the U.S. Marshals to engage? Does the local or the authority that is looking for this bad guy have to call you in or all the above? How does that work?
Well, there's two types of warrants that we work. And one of them, obviously, the federal warrants that come out of federal courts. We automatically take those and start working those. But I also have fugitive multi-agency fugitive task forces throughout the state in Phoenix, Tucson, Yuma, and Flagstaff, where our four offices are. And let's say, for example, Tucson PD has a murder, and they have a suspect, and they believe that suspect has left the area. Then, as part of the task force, we would adopt that case and start looking for that individual. And this happens all the time. And so we would adopt that case and start looking for that individual. Also, because we're so close to Mexico, we have a lot of fugitives that flee to Mexico, and that's interesting, working fugitives in Mexico. And I have 8 deputy marshals who work fugitives in Mexico full time, but they could go anywhere. I mean, Europe, South America, Canada, you name it. We'll have deputies go all over around the world, hunting down these fugitives, and it's an advantage for, say, a Tucson PD is that they have 4,000 deputy marshals nationally that will assist on these cases where say Tucson PD might not have the resources to hunt these individuals down, and the cost associated with that. All they got to do is give us a call. And like I said, we'll adopt that case and find that individual for him.
David, this is a very, very dangerous business. I heard an interview where you mentioned that the U.S. Marshals are involved in more critical shootings than any other federal agency. Tell us real briefly, if you don't mind, about badge number 31134, Deputy Marshal Chase White.
Oh, this is the worst day of my life, Ben. On November 29th, 2018, Deputy Marshal Chase White was shot and killed. Just in Tucson, north of downtown, there was an individual, and I can't talk a lot about that case because still the trial is pending, but, this individual was wanted by the Tucson PD, for harassing, officers there. This individual had some issues and was causing a lot of problems for Tucson PD. A warrant was obtained for him, and they asked if we would go arrest this individual. As we went to his home, he started shooting from inside out, and he struck Deputy Chase White, and he was killed. Think about him and that situation every day. I was hoping that when I do leave as the head of the Marshal Service for Arizona, that I would never have an officer shot and killed in line of duty, and I think about him and his wife and his four kids and the impact it had not just on the Tucson community with the Marshal Service there and nationally.
Well, and I didn't mean to bring up a bad subject. I believe as long as we mention their names, they're not forgotten. So, Deputy Marshal Chase White, badge number 31134. David, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want you to give a wrap. Ben's dumb question of the show, and I've always wondered this. So you've got the 15 most wanted. There's $50,000 reward. Let's say it's a cyber criminal who can find me anywhere. How do you actually – I want to be anonymous. How do you actually pay me without there being a check from the Treasury that the bad guys can track me down? I mean, do you put a bag of cash under a park bench somewhere, or how does that work?
Yeah. Yes. Sometimes we do. Yeah, and, we recently paid somebody, just an example, not too long ago, $20,000 on a top 15 fugitive, and we met that individual in another country, and paid him cash,
My producer's raising his hands like, I know a couple guys I'm going to rat out right now.
Is
that tax-free?
Yes.
Wow.
Yep. It is.
Fascinating.
Yes, it
okay.
Is.
Well, that's
yeah.
Ben got the answer to his dumb question. David.
No, it wasn't a dumb question. Yeah.
Just 2 minutes left. Two things. One is, what would you, for somebody who's thinking about becoming a deputy U.S. Marshal, what would you look for? And then if you don't mind, wrap with another quote that I heard you mention that I just love. Don't water plastic plants.
Oh, don't water plastic plants. Yes. And, I got that from an old DPS sergeant of mine, and I was in the Highway Patrol. And first thing he said to me is that, don't water plastic plants, meaning don't waste your time, energy, resources on things that aren't going to grow. And I think it's a good something to follow for anybody, in my opinion. And we've all been there at some time or another.
What are you looking for in a marshal?
Well, what we're looking for deputy marshals are people that are well-rounded. We don't care what your college degree's in. We're just looking for somebody that has good common sense, has a great attitude and good work ethic. When I'm hiring deputy marshals, there's people that can give a good interview, but it's the background that's important. And if you have a great attitude, if you have a good work ethic, you're going to be a great cop and a great deputy U.S. marshal. All the other stuff we can train you to do, but you can't train somebody, or you can't make somebody, you can't force them to have a good work ethic, and you can't, and in a lot of most cases, change someone's attitude about things. But if you come that way, you're 90% there.
And no prior law enforcement experience necessarily?
No, it does, and it's not necessary, but because okay. We're looking for all kinds of backgrounds. Okay. I like to hire former street cops because they bring a certain skill set to the job, but also language skills, IT skills, financial skills.
David, we've got to run. I'm officially turning in my U.S. Deputy Marshal badge for the hour. Thank you so much for spending time with us today, and please be safe.
Thank you for letting me talk about the Marshal Service today.
Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.